You're listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio. I'm Casey Gilman. The College Connection is a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. This forum provides an opportunity for listeners to engage with the researchers, intellectuals, poets, and authors active within our academic communities. Poet Gerald Stern was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in 1925. The prized American author was educated at the University of Pittsburgh, Columbia University, and attended the University of Paris for postgraduate study. He said his poetry is influenced by his working-class upbringing and Jewish and Eastern European heritage. Stern's reading from a collection of his works was recorded on October 25, 2016, in the Weinstein Auditorium at Smith College.
I think I have 25 books of poetry. And I thought I would give a retrospective tonight, but it took me 45 minutes to read the titles. Alan has put together a little booklet that we use this afternoon, and I'm going to read a few poems from there that sort of summarize things. And I'm going to introduce tonight my next book. I have here what they call the advanced reading copy, full of errors, it says, and not for sale. And I'm going to read about 10 poems or so from there. And then I'm going to read a few recent poems. These are not recent. They're only 3 months old. And I'm going to end with one poem I want you to hear from a few years ago. So I think I'll just get started and not be a silver-tongued raconteur. I'll be an iron-tongued. And I'm just going to, I'm not going to identify which book the poems are from and all that junk. I'll just start reading some of the poems that Alan has collected in his sweet little booklet we talked about this afternoon. Some will be recent, some will be long ago. This is a poem that has been anthologized a little bit, an early-ish poem called The Dancing. And I wrote it when I first arrived in Iowa, and I was looking for, I belong to an odd profession. Where you take a new job, you still think you're a graduate student, even though you're making a lot of money. So you go to Goodwill and you buy a used toaster, and if you're a cheapskate like me, you bring in a couple pieces of bread to make sure the toaster, which might cost a dollar, is still working. And in that first visit to Goodwill, I saw a kind of radio that we had in Pittsburgh, a Philco. It was called a Philco. I don't know if that's still in business, Philco. And it had, you put a record in it, it had an automatic eye that put the sound on, the needle on the record, and destroyed it. So that's what starts the poem. In all these rotten shops, and all this broken furniture and wrinkled ties and baseball trophies and coffee pots, I have never seen a post-war Philco with the automatic eye, nor heard Ravel's Bolero the way I did in 1945 in that tiny living room on Beechwood Boulevard, nor danced as I did then, my knives all flashing, my hair all streaming, my mother red with laughter, my father cupping his left hand under his armpit, doing the dance of old Ukraine, the sound of his skin half drum, half fart, the world at last a meadow, the three of us whirling and singing, the three of us screaming and falling, as if we were dying, as if we could never stop, in 1945, in Pittsburgh, beautiful, filthy Pittsburgh, home of the evil melons, 5,000 miles away from the other dancing in Poland and Germany. O God of mercy, O wild God. Someone asked me a question this afternoon about writing about animals, and I said I also wrote about fruit and vegetables. So I'm going to read a poem from American Sonnets about a pear. It's called September 1999. I guess that's when I wrote it. I was thinking about pears, or you were, don't remember who first started to think, though you said Seckle pears, I said Bartlett, and nothing I could do could budge you. I could cut the skin so quickly and keep it so thin, the light goes through it. And I held it to the light to catch the rose, and I knew when the core was already brown and it was spreading just by touching the flesh, and sometimes the neck was gone as far as eating, though you would call it the nose, you with your seckles, you with your freckles. And no one but me has quite such pleasure extruding the stem. And no one I know puts a pear in his coat pocket when he goes out in the rain as I do. Though what was the pleasure eating in sheets of water compared to the loneliness eating by yourself? And even though hornets were in your bowl, and 10 or 20 were crawling over a rotten peach, and 3 or 4 were already after my pear, since it was autumn again and hornets were dying, and they were angry and drunk, I just wiped them away. I can't remember which books these are from, which is just as well. This is called a short poem called The Law. The world is always burning. You should fly from the burning if you can, and you should hold your head, oh, either above or below the dust. And you should be careful in the blocks of Bowery, below or above the broom, that always is changing from one kind of drunkenness to another. For that is the law of suffering, and you know it. And here's a poem, a Jewish toast called L'Chaim. There goes that toast again, 4 chipped glasses full of some kind of ruby, held up so to the sun this time, death crumbs falling and rising like dust motes, fish eggs, bubbles. Here's to you, bubbles. Here's to Mardi Gras, here's to the apple tree pinned against my fence. Here's to reproach, here's to doing it to music, here's to fog, and here's to fog again, and life dividing inside the fog. Oh, when it dissipates, let's make a circle. Here's to the baby hiding inside his clothes. Here's to his being alive without me. Here's to the mountain again, for what the hell, I might as well be on the mountain. Here's to delectables, free health care, love, popcorn. Oh, yeah. I was writing a whole bunch of poems about flutes. Since it was birdseed and plates of water and leftovers and there was nothing going up or down, I sat against the fence underneath my maple and listened to thunder for starters. And since where I lived there wasn't a flute for miles, I did without, though I will never quit being shocked at the stops, how music comes from holes, including darkness and light and joy and gloom, and I have come to honor my fence above the others, for it is a chain link, and in its way it modulates. The fences both left and right, they hardly do, and dogwood is out now, here and there, mine has a skirt, and it will blossom for a week. It's like a bush more than a tree, but it contains the same dark, bloody history. And the redbud, too, and even the locust. And if you live long enough, you will die knowing it. Okay, the last question I was asked this afternoon was by my friend Barbara Rez. And as I recall, the question was something like, and I didn't answer it, I said I would try to answer it tonight. The difference in a poem between celebration and mourning. And I said, well, they're often tied together and they can be the same thing. And I have a poem about that. Well, I looked at the poem and That's partially true, but I'll read the poem, and it's for Barbara that I'm reading this. It's called One Poet. As if one poet then who was in his 60s, I wanted to tell him that I read his book and how I lingered on one page and couldn't go to the next. I had to read it again, and later I kissed it. But I couldn't tell him that, nor did I ever write since I lost his letter. I remember putting it in my inside pocket with the colored pens and how it must have slipped out as I ran down the four steps and over the forsythia looking for my keys. And at the annual ceremony, somewhere close, I think, to Gramercy Park, he barked at me, not knowing how much I loved his work, nor did he see out of the dusty window left of the cloakroom how a dog had severed the head of a pigeon and how its bloody feathers lay on the sidewalk and blood was on the dog's round face and how oddly he growled and how he licked his lips. So I don't know if that answers the question or not, or confuses it. Henry Lyman, my friend, is here now. Where is Henry? And for a long time, a friend of mine from Pittsburgh, well-known poet Jack Gilbert, lived in, I think, the apartment above Henry's garage. And Henry sort of took care of him in many ways. Jack died about 3 or 4 years ago. The day he died, I walked into the kitchen of my house in Lambertville, New Jersey, and I fell down. I fell on the floor and shouted, and my assistant was upstairs, and she ran down, and she was talking to my wife, Anne Marie, and she said, Jerry fell because Jack died that morning, and Anne Marie said, he pushed him down. Well, Jack and I and another friend, Richard Hazley, were in France together, and I hope I'm not hurting his loving memory by saying that Jack often succeeded in getting free meals but with the grace of his friends. We would go to restaurants, and somehow Jack would never have the money to pay his share. And we got into the habit, Dick and I, of when we were supposed to meet him, we would run away and go to a restaurant. Or this, I could tell you, like 50 stories like this, spend the whole night. But I wrote a poem about this, and it's called Grace Hopper. James Joyce, in Finnegan's Wake, rephrasing the Aesop fable of the ant and the grasshopper, where the ant works all night, and the grasshopper just, you know, spits tobacco and digs life, Jack, and comes winter, and according to Aesop's fables, and you know, the grasshopper's hungry, but the ant is relentless. And the way Ovid lectured a green grasshopper, and all the grasshopper did was spit up tobacco. And the way he begged for food, for he was the first Bohemian, though he detested the brutal word grasshopper, see James Joyce. And when two ants ran around the corner when it was dinner, and how the grasshopper wept, and it was cold on top of the cold stone wall, though dinner cost at most, say, 20 cents, and how the ants reasoned, and how the grasshopper, and what the stakes were, and what the dream was, see Aesop. Okay, one more maybe. Okay, this is a show of poem. Many Jews, when they, you know, boarded trains or cattle cars on their way to camps or temporary places, took suitcases with them. And this is about an imaginary person named Rosenblatt and his suitcase. The most revolting thing of all was carrying a suitcase through the gate, for that was mixing your journeys, even wearing an overcoat or socks with clocks inside your shoes was stupid, but nothing compared to a suitcase, amazing compartments for matching neckties and handkerchiefs, and one for underwear and one for toilet articles, which when it was forced open, for who had such a tiny key? There was your name burned in the leather, nor did the scallop bottles spill, dear rose petal, son of a Hamburg kosher fishmonger. I'll read one more poem from this collection. This is called Wilderness. Given how dear are pests now, you'd think it was no big thing watching one run up Union Street at 6 in the morning in the middle of town looking for a woods, though he may have smelled the river, which only confused him, or at least that's what I think. At least that's what I think. And he turned right on Jefferson toward the hills, if you consider the corner where an impatient woman was running in place and we went softly in different directions, for we were too ashamed to look at each other. I'm going to read one more poem from American Sonnets. It's called Roses. Roses, you know, have named after actors and presidents and criminals. There was a rose called Guy de Maupassant, a carmine pink that smelled like a Granny Smith. And there was another from the 17th century that wept too much and wilted when you looked, and one that caused tuberculosis. Doctors dug them up. They wore white masks and posted warnings in the windows. One wet day it started to hail and pellets the size of snowballs fell on the roses. It's hard for me to look at a Duchess of Windsor. It was worn by Franco and Mussolini. It stabbed Jews. Yesterday, I bought 6 roses from a Haitian on Lower Broadway. He wrapped them in blue tissue paper. It was starting to snow, and both of us had on the wrong shoes. Though it was windy, he said, not snow, that ruined roses, and all you had to do was hold them against your chest. He had a ring on his pinky the size of a grape, and half his teeth were gone. So I loved him and spoke to him in false Creole, for which he hugged me and enveloped me in his camel hair coat with most of the buttons missing. And we were brothers for life. We swore it in French. So this is a book called Galaxy Love that's coming out in February. I'm going to read a few poems from that. So I'll just tell you the titles and read the poems. This one's called Blue Particles. And I'll leave it up to you to see where the difference in languages and usage and such, for I'm not a critic of my own work too much. This is about rabbits. Coney Island in New York, a coney is a rabbit. And it was an island full of rabbits, and that's where it got its name. Don't ever think of Coney Island where the rabbits once ran wild, or the afternoon we went swimming, though it was only May, for we had graduated and we spent the night eating hot dogs at Nathan's and took the screamer back to 96th Street. Nor should you love too much the white pole on the long and noisy ride through Brooklyn, the number 2 that delivered you to your front door, the Dutch freighter that delivered you to Antwerp, then to Gare du Nord. Nor your stubbornness every morning at the small table and what it was like to walk out into the sunlight and how the blue particles were your chief influence. That and the Book of Isaiah and King Lear rolling in the dirt on Chalk Mountain, the early part of your life. I'm going to read a poem I said I would this afternoon. about Larry Levis, great poet who died B times. And it's called Perish the Day, which is, as you know, I hope, is from Job. Perish the day on which I was born. It's not just Larry. Okay, now a few things about Larry. He's from the West Coast. He loved horses. He was a student of Phil Levine's. That's enough. And he wrote a beautiful poem about the memorial to the Vietnam War in New York. It's not just Larry who keeps going to meetings when there's no one there. I went to one in the latrine where a body was hanging from a pipe and a finger had written in vapor, just a warning. But whoever dragged him in forgot to take his boots off before or after, and there was only one person there, one live person, and he was cleaning the toilet with Ajax, the magic cleanser. And he had an Irish accent mixed with English I myself heard in Scotland, so that makes two. When in walks Larry, and then for an hour or more, he and Jonathan Swift, the Ajax man, talked horses, and as Larry said, an angel disguised as a fly flew into the ear, then into the brain of the horse. You should watch where you put the swab, and you should scratch the smooth skin closest to the skull so your hand can slip onto the horse's head, which he would shake free and move along the fence so he could bend down for new weed. And as for the meeting, it lasted just long enough to cut the dead man down and wash him off, but it was hard getting the boots off without cutting or snipping, for there were no laces. That's what I want to say. There were no laces on the day we unhanged him. Here's a poem called Lips. I think this is about, when I was in junior high school, my music teacher, Miss Steiner, I was in the orchestras, for a day or so, and she gave me a French horn to play. I had thick lips, I couldn't make any sound come from the damn French horn, so she switched me to a trombone, which I played for a while, till my neighbors signed a petition to have me stop playing the French horn. What was it I was playing? Yeah. Okay, this is on page 59. Sitting with his friend, he learned how shameful it was to have played the golden trombone and not the wooden flute, and to have blasted his own way into manhood that way, instead of making a soft sound with his mouth and fingers. But he was stubborn, and anyhow, he had thick lips, which stood him in good stead in one case, but not the other. And furthermore, his friends had died. One, two, three, one after another, and he was left to his own devices, I would say his own instruments. He could have considered a harp, or in his case, a lyre, and found a tall stool to display his wares. I haven't forgotten that, for he wasn't finally restricted to one thing. Indeed, a mouth organ, if push came to shove, something he could almost swallow for the drama's sake. Think of him getting rid of spit and warming up behind the French horns. The French horns he hated beyond anything for their thin lips and their benevolent sounds. Here's a poem called, like many people, I was a newsboy and I delivered the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph. It's a poem about that. The one thing that kept me going above all else were the potatoes we roasted in the burning ash. And for their sake, I made one trip too many on the three-bladed sled. I was the one with a salt shaker, which I wrapped in wax paper and stuffed into my jacket pocket. I still had three newspapers left, but they were of no use since the edges of the front sections were brown already and curled, so we paid no attention to the melt which had already started in southern Ohio and was working its way quickly across West Virginia and Pennsylvania, since they always reported the weather on page one, and that information was burned to a crisp. My friend William Merwin, who lives in Hawaii, I wrote this poem for him. He's losing his eyesight, or he's probably lost it already. And I wrote this poem for him about a year ago. We used to take long walks in New York, and he talk about people who love animals, he loved dogs. And it was the early 80s, and there was, you know, things were bad in New York, and you walked around with quarters in your pocket to give to beggars. And there was a guy with a dog, and we gave him some quarters, and we were talking, and all of a sudden he ran back two blocks to give the guy more money because of the dog. The way it was in the 80s, when we carried pockets full of quarters to give to the destitute, and William ran a whole block south once to give extra quarters because of the man's dog, a second giving for him, and it was his own chow. He mourned for weeks on end, and how delighted he was and shocked to see the chow next door with his characteristic blue tongue and his proud and distant way, so that now in the time of no age that we share together, though across 6 hours of land and six or more of water, I think of him writing in his room full of white light, as our friend Mary Ann describes it, where he's loading his pockets and he will run down the best he can to give a second time to the man with a border collie, though it's more like a third time now that I think of it. It's a poem called Thieves and Murderers. You know, in the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance, even if, like Villon, you were a murderer, if you could read Latin, they would not hang you. It doesn't work in America. In Texas, it doesn't work. In Texas, you say, I'm going to read Latin. You turn the thing down. Don't inject me. And say, yeah, what's Latin? I think the guy's name was Trump. That was when I was reading Villon and fell in love forever with thieves and murderers, as long as they could rhyme in Latin and French. But long after forever, I changed again, though I didn't want to become too Eisenhower-ish. He who fell under the desk at the first sign of a bomb. He who made love to his driver, and as I remember, was scolded by George Marshall, and a little later made his maiden speech at Columbia, where he was being prepared. For what's good for Raisin Bran is good for America. Days on end, I watched Orson Welles and his company rehearse Macbeth in a small French church somewhere on the other bank, which stood him in good stead after he returned to the land of his fathers, my uncles. I was back to thieves and murderers then, where there were strings galore and odes and dirges on the first and second floor. Old TA 611, where the flying fishes play and the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay, with a little help from Kipling there. Okay, here is I'm going to read a couple more from this book, a poem called Ancient Chinese Egg. I had another poem about that egg. I was giving a reading somewhere near Philadelphia, and this cabinet was open, and it had I was told was a 1,000-year-old egg in it, and I took the egg. I later found out it was only 500 years old. This is called Ancient Chinese Egg. I counted wrong in the other poem. It was 500 years, not 1,000. So that meant the egg was cooked during the time of Ben Jonson. It also was neither simmered nor steamed, but baked in the sun on the heated rocks. I'd say 3 minutes, in the way we keep time in this era. And since I obtained it in 1970, it had to be the grandson, and the poets were late Ming. And one of them wrote about the swarm of flies on his sick horse and what the smell of blood was. And one of them wrote about his pauvre hut in the mountains as if it were still early Tang. But what the hell, a hut is a hut, be it this, be it that. And self-pity in terms of the geese coming north is the same both here and there. The egg on the outside was perfect, though I'm a little nervosa of what I'd find inside, so I tossed it from hand to hand, stopping once or twice to read and reread the certificate of priceless possession and how I could reduce the value to zero by just two gulps or a few nibbles at the parameters. But one of them wrote of his life wasted on weights and measures and how his shoes were ruined by the time he got home, for he couldn't carry them swinging from side to side while he walked barefoot the 1,000 miles, for he was too old and soft and had a waddle under his chin. He'd have to stop dozens of times. And consider that though the Manchu regime was coming in Europe, it was no better, though since it was almost June, he still could be saved by the tragic, solitary, dark red iris forcing its way again through the dense green hedges. And I'll read maybe two more from this book. This one's called Hamlet Naked. This is a celebration of the old days in Times Square, before Lion King came its way. When the movies opened at 11 in the morning and you had dozens of bad movies to choose from, people were sleepy there all night and it smelled of urine. That was beautiful days. It was a theater west on 47th that smelled inside of urine, both upstairs and down. You wouldn't believe it, but it was Hamlet Naked, not Lear, not Love, next door to where 10 or so men were facing the walls and swaying in what was called a bookstore across the street from Nedick's, orange soda and hot dogs, for which I'll say just this, that some could bend their knees while swaying and move their lips and shut their books with a loud amen. When I walked east past Broadway, I hesitated too long, and by this act I had to press the button twice to change the red to green, for I was in a fog and someone should light a bonfire since I could walk wherever I wanted then and didn't know north from south or east from west. Nor was it Pap, his Hamlet, circa 1968, nor Dante naked, nor Faust. It was instead your normal lewdness posing in a half-hearted way as art. I was ironic then as I am now, but my head was too far down as if I were looking for nickels, though anything less than a quarter, I wouldn't disgrace myself. Maybe I was looking at the metal doors open to let the light down into the cellar. Gregory Corso playing the harmonica, Diana trilling with a toy cello. Both I saw one day on Avenue A among the bags of rice and the boxes of lettuce. The old Ukrainian restaurant, which this late date could be an expensive Armenian or Ethiopian diner sucking it up with chunks of bread, for there is nothing but improvement now among the lettered streets. And there was a learned couple with a five-year-old, all three had matching neckties. I want to wear one when I go into the cellar. I want to be arrested for causing havoc, especially when a crowd gathers around the opening. In New York, a crowd can form in a second. Think of Gregory, a blue jay on his head. Think of Diana seeing a live rat. Think of me lying on the gunny sacks, my left arm up, conducting. Okay. And I'll read a poem called Fall 1960, page 117. And this poem, I think I referred to it this afternoon. I may have misremembered a little or collapsed two things together that happened at different times. One was Khrushchev banging his shoe, his big black shoe, when to interrupt the speaker at the UN. Some of you may have heard of that. And the other, and I don't know if this happened at the same meeting of the UN. Castro came to the U.S. and he went to stayed at a hotel in Harlem called the Teresa, and they brought their own chickens from Cuba, for they thought they would be poisoned by the Dulles brothers who ran America. John Foster Dulles, who was the Secretary of State under Eisenhower and told him what to do, and Alan Dulles, who was the president of famous college in Baltimore? Yeah, yeah. Castro himself, you won't believe it, ate Wheaties for breakfast at his hotel in Harlem. I remember it was at Teresa, and they cooked chicken in the kitchen they brought over from Cuba, for they were afraid John Foster Dulles or his brother Alan Dulles might poison them. And Khrushchev took off his heavy black shoe and turned on the radio at 4:45 when the serials were playing to hear the latest adventure of Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy. And I even stopped kissing my close friend's wife while he was in the bathtub, soaking, drunk, and singing songs from the islands off Messina. He who worked for the Quakers and was fired for drinking and singing, though soaking was acceptable. Here is the song, and I sang it to this, and I'll sing it to you. We, the Piper Hudson High boys, show them how we stand. Never tired of Wheaties, the best food in the land. So won't you try Wheaties, the best breakfast food in the land. That's the way Jack Armstrong would always start. And it would end up with him hanging by his nails, you know, from a window and such. That went on day after day. And it's getting late. And I'm going to read one more poem. I was going to read some recent poems, but I don't know what happened to them. They're here somewhere, but I've read enough. This is a poem from my book called Last Blue. And it's called Last Blue. And you will notice, and I'll make this comment about my writing, that I do indulge in a bit of solipsism. I write about what I know about and hold dear, or am passionate about or hate. And if the reader gets it, be it Wheaties or Alan Dulles or whatever, I'm delighted. If he or she doesn't, I'm equally delighted. For it's the music that counts. This is about the color blue, which was the color of death in Egypt and the color of life among the Hebrews. You want to get the color blue right. Just drink some blue milk from a blue cup. Wait for the blue light of morning or evening with its blue aftermath. You want to understand? Look at the parking lines outside my window, the neon moon outside Jabberwockies. And funk, you have to know funk, a touch of blue at the base of the spine, long threads going into your heart, a steaming fountain you pour into your own bowl. My dead sister's eyes, those of her porcelain twin at the Lambertville Flea, $20 a day for the small table, all the merit you need to get you across the river, and one kind of blue for a robin's egg, and one kind of blue for a bottle of ink, two minds to fathom the difference. Your earrings, which as far as I can see are there as much to play with as to look at, your blue pencil, which makes your eyes Egyptian, bluebells, bluebirds from Austin, Texas, the dead hackster who drank potassium, Governor Bush, he was still governor, Governor Bush, who drank milk of magnesia, a chorus of saints from Wiley Avenue, and One Kind of Blue for my first prayer shawl, and One Kind of Blue for the robe Fra Lippo gave to Mary. Blue from Mexico and blue from Greece, that's where the difference lay between them in the blues. A room full of scholars in Montreal 1 year, in New York City another, that is blue. Blue was their speech, blue were their male and female neckties, their food was blue, their cars were rented, Christmas lights were in the lobby. One of the bars had peanuts in all the urns, and on the upper floors, the hospitality rooms were crowded with livid sapphire cobalt faces. I was blue going into the tunnel. I am blue every night at 3 or 4 o'clock. Our herring was blue. We ate it with Russian rye and boiled potatoes, and in the summer, fresh tomatoes and coffee mixed with sugar and milk. I sat in a chair so close to Sonny Terry, I could hear him mumble the criticism he made of his own sorrow. But I was that close to Pablo Casals in 1950, talk about blue. And though I left it 1,000 times, I stood, since I didn't have a seat, in front of an open window of Beth Israel in Philadelphia to hear the sobbing. Such a voice. A dog came up to me that night out of the blue and put his muzzle in my hand. Nor would he leave me for a minute. He would have stayed with me forever and followed me up to my house, which butted onto the woods in back of the synagogue, and sat outside my door, or blew on the street outside a parlor near the Port Authority, my seat inside, or blew in Ocean Grove where sky and sea combined, and walking the boardwalk into the wind, and blew in a shrink's small parking lot, watching the clock, and blew in my mother's arms, always comforting her, and blew with my daughter starving herself, and blew with my wife all day playing solitaire or drawing houses, and blew, though smiling, when I came into the world. They called me Jess Willard, 13 pounds, and I had just hammered Jack Dempsey into the ropes, and I was shouting in a tinny voice. It sounded like someone weeping. It always sounded like that. Everything living.
That was prized American poet Gerald Stern, recorded on October 25th, 2016, in the Weinstein Auditorium at Smith College. Next, an excerpt from Catherine Chin's talk, Marvelous Things Heard, History and the Problem of Weirdness, recorded on December 8, 2016, in the Kendade Hall at Mount Holyoke College. Chin, Associate Professor of Classics at the University of California, Davis, encouraged historians to embrace and include weirdness and what she refers to as historical radiance when studying and writing about the past.
Whereas fame and renown are clearly human phenomena, the idea of radiance does not imply dependence on human action. The sun is radiant. It would be strange to call it famous, despite the many poetic utterances it has inspired. Radiance, that is, implies some source of light or energy, a force of some kind that originates somewhere outside of those who see it. Radiance is something that is encountered. I'd like to suggest that radiance in a historical context can be understood as the force of alterity. It's the force of the past's otherness, an otherness that can never be entirely domesticated. Now, when I say that this radiance is not under human control, I don't mean to revert to either a theological view of history or to a view of history in which we have anything like unmediated access to the past. The past does not simply appear without human intervention. Indeed, the depths of the past's absence requires a complex set of mediations in order for us to see that past as past at all. The worn and broken columns in the center of Rome, for example, are things that we see now, not things that we see in some other world called the past. Seeing them as past objects requires a particular twist of the imagination that creates another world and consigns it to destruction at the same time. And although we sometimes consider historical training to be training in the production of knowledge about the past, I think it's useful to think of it also as training in the practice of loss. It may even be the case that the historian should be better at losing things than at finding them. For the intense richness of the past is by definition more gone than it is here. The intellectual habit of producing historical loss, however, is also the practice of training oneself to experience the force of the past's otherness, since the context of deep loss is what generates the radiance, the overwhelming otherness of what is found. The more richly we can learn to imagine what is lost, the more other the past must become. Historical loss is the process through which Herodotus attempts to preserve simple kleos, but we see it today through Bloch and Putnam as radiance. Now, I would say that a historian describing the pre-modern world has one extremely powerful advantage over a historian describing the modern one, and that is that the pre-modern world is very far away from us in time. So its loss is much easier for us to imagine. The historical period I specialize in, late antiquity, for its inhabitants, worked by a very different set of spiritual, scientific, economic, and material rules than our lives do now. Technologies have changed, intellectual models have been replaced, structures of power, cities, and even landscapes have simply disappeared. In studying the past, especially the faraway past, we encounter modes of being in the world that are deeply different from our own. And experiencing this encounter is an immense privilege. I would go so far as to say that there is an inordinate benefit even to the sheer poverty of evidence that we now have about late antiquity. The deep distanciation in time and the great incompleteness of our knowledge force us to grapple in a very direct way with the otherness and hence the radiance of these past worlds. So to the extent that historical inquiry seeks to find the radiant alterity of the past and thus to expand the boundaries of what it means to exist in any world, those of us who are lucky enough to study the faraway past may be closer to that radiance precisely because the past from which it emanates is so easily understood to be distant. Now, of course, catching a glimpse of otherness is not fundamentally dependent on linear temporal distance. Instead, it's a habit of looking and a practice of inference that can be exercised with greater or lesser intellectual tenacity. The question is one of domestication. How willing are we to try to recover the interior logics of a world that is different from our own? There are ways in which the human inhabitants of past worlds can appear to be like us. They ate and drank, worked, had sex, raised children, fell ill, passed away. But all such activities also had dimensions that were very much not like our own lives. What is eating and drinking in a localized agrarian economy that's subject to intense periodic famines and is under the control of unfathomable deities? What is it to raise a child in a setting in which infant mortality rates and rates of death in childbirth were, by modern standards, shockingly high, and child exposure was a sanctioned possibility? What is it to fall ill when amulets and exorcisms are mainstream practices of healing? These are very simple examples, but they present the historian with a set of decisions about whether to focus on the strangeness of these activities or on their similarities to behaviors that we more easily understand. There are certainly times when limiting the strangeness in our historical inquiries is desirable. but the full radiance of the past cannot be seen without an attempt to connect these familiarities to the outright weirdness that surrounds them. Finding historical radiance is the practice of inferring the unstated logic that connects what child rearing was to what child exposure was, or what a 6th-century plague in Rome was to what Gregory the Great's vision of an angel ending that plague might have been. The decision to focus on the otherness of past worlds rather than their similarities to our own requires a particular view of what writing history is. If writing history is an attempt to address the question, how can we most fully describe the events of the past in ways that make sense according to our own understanding of how the world works, if that's the question, then we will probably tend to shy away from events that strike us as strange. If, on the other hand, the question we are asking is, how can we, living in our own world, experience something of what it is like to live in another world, then we will likely be more interested in what I am calling historical radiance. Recovering the radiant alterity of the past does not necessarily mean believing strange accounts. Personally, I do not believe that the now extinct European aurochs, which is agreed to have been the template for the animal that pseudo-Aristotle calls the bolinthus, defended itself by squirting burning shit at hunting dogs 20 feet away. Deciding to focus on otherness does mean, however, actively incorporating strange accounts into any narrative that is meant to describe the worlds in which they made sense. Whether or not we believe these things to be true, we cannot give a true account of the past without giving them their full weight as part of the strange worlds our subjects lived in. This recognition of alterity requires us to refuse to domesticate the bizarre and even the horrible in our accounts of the past. Radiance, far from being merely attractiveness, includes the force of an otherness that we may at times wish to disavow. It includes the horror of child exposure and slave economics as fully connected to the more palatable and entertaining weirdness of miracle stories. In all cases, however, radiance is experienced as the unsettling force of encounter, rather than the reassuring process of explanation. Now we start talking about how we do this as historians. I'd suggest, moreover, that searching for historical radiance is not merely a matter of responsibility to the historical record. It is, in addition, the cultivation of a particular kind of aesthetic sensibility. To return to Marc Bloch briefly, it's worth remembering that he locates the beginning of historical inquiry in pleasure. Quote, "The same is true of any intellectual discipline, but history has its peculiar aesthetic pleasures. The spectacle of human activity, which forms its particular object, is more than any other designed to seduce the imagination. Above all, when, thanks to its remoteness in time or space, it is adorned with the subtle enchantment of the unfamiliar." Unquote. While it would not be entirely fair to Bloch to suggest that this is his primary justification for the practice of history, although it's probably my primary justification for the practice of history, it's certainly true that the capacity to be surprised, even delighted, by the sheer unfamiliarity of the past is a fundamental skill for any historian. This surprise is an aesthetic experience in the basic sense that it is about perception, but it's also often aesthetic in the more conventional sense that the force of the past's otherness, its radiance, constitutes a kind of beauty, or at least is related to the beautiful. As Elaine Scarry writes of aesthetic experience, quote, "At the moment we see something beautiful, we undergo a radical decentering. It is not that we cease to stand at the center of the world, for we never stood there. It is that we cease to stand even at the center of our own world. we willingly cede our ground to the thing that stands before us." Unquote. This decentering and ceding of ground should also be the effect of encountering the strangeness of the past. We are prompted to imagine a world that unfolds, that in fact did unfold, entirely without us, outside of both our own experience and our own logic. The historical figures that we encounter are not radiant to us as examples of what we are, only better, or sometimes only worse, but as configurations of an otherness that we had not previously imagined existing. They are radiant insofar as they are expansions of the modes of otherness that are available to us in the world. Seeking historical radiance is, in this way, a mental habit of making room for others in the world. Now, this mental habit of looking for otherness and inferring the strange logics that connect it to the apparently familiar, this is only one part of the task of radiant historiography. The other part is representing this radiance in our own writing. This can be done in a couple of ways. First, through different modes of critical description, for which there are actually many precedents in modern history writing, as well as through aesthetic representation, for which there are fewer precedents. So first, let's consider critical description. In some respects, the practice of describing radiance that I'm trying to encourage is indebted to certain developments in and reactions to the Annales school of historical writing overall. So we're back to the Annales school, like I promised. In the early and mid 20th century, the analysts emphasized both the expansion of the scale of history to periods far longer than any human lifetime, and they also attempted to analyze the thought habits, or famously the mentalities, of past societies as modes of understanding human experience. This shift in scale and examination of intellectual difference precluded easy identification between the historian and the subjects of history. Now, this narrative project of shifting the scale of inquiry and focusing on alterity returns us to the strangenesses of natural history with which we started. The non-human world, of course, sort of by definition, doesn't limit itself to a human scale and possesses its own radiant otherness. Now, there's obviously no human world that exists separately from the non-human world, and the entanglements between all of a world's inhabitants make up the internal logic of that world. So for that reason, it's, I think, fair to say that all descriptions of the logic of worlds are, in some sense, ecological descriptions, descriptions of encounters between many different kinds of beings acting on and interacting on many different kinds of scales. Thank you.
You've been listening to The College Connection from New England Public Radio, a series of lectures from visiting and local speakers given and recorded at the five colleges. You can find more College Connection online at nepr.net or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. For New England Public Radio, I'm Casey Gilman.